are all pending lawsuits, with some payments totaling several million dollars. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 6:01. And coming up next, tune in, turn on, remember.
Welcome to the final episode of Tune In, Turn On, Remember, 45 years of KBOO history. I'm Dan Johnson. It might be safe to say that KBOO has been building community for the last 45 years, and we've all been a part of the history in the making. Jenka Soderberg and I have hosted this year-long event, bringing you so many highlights of those involved with KBOO from way back then to here and now. Please enjoy this final hour of Tune In, Turn On, Remember. During the year, Jenka filed this story about some happenings at Pacifica, which originally aired on Democracy Now! This occurred in 1999.
We are going to hear what the KPFA news sounded like last night. It was about 6:10 Pacific Standard Time when their news goes on. Mark Miracle was doing the cast, the news director at KPFA, and he was running a Pacifica national piece. I believe it was on health care. You're going to hear excerpts, tiny excerpts of that piece, but it was continually turned off. We'll find out why later, and then you'll hear the room sound of what happened.
Range of American society. It's the majority of the uninsured are white, minority.
I'm nervous. I'm afraid you're going to hurt me. You're going to shoot me.
African Americans.
I have belongings here. Excuse me. You cannot.
Ma'am, we interrupt the story from Mark Beavis on HMO because Dennis Bernstein of France Flashpoint has been put on administrative leave for his playing of a press conference concerning the crisis here at KPFA on Flashpoint just within the last half an hour. The KPFA, the guards that Pacifica has placed in KPFA are trying to drag him out of the studio.
The press conference. And here you are, ready to...
And you can hear that in the background.
What is Pacifica coming to?
Garland Ganter, who is the general manager of the Pacifica station in Houston, was brought in by Pacific Executive Director.
And that was the end of the local newscast at KPFA in Berkeley, at which point the plug was pulled and it went to tape programming that has been running since then from the Pacifica archives.
We've been listening to a clip of a Democracy Now! Segment that aired in March of 1999 during the Pacifica Radio Network crisis. You're listening to a KBOO special, Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, 45 years of KBOO history. Tonight's show is focusing on a crisis that rocked the world of community radio in 1999, when the Pacifica Radio Network faced an attempted corporate takeover, the firing of staff, and the hiring of union-busting law firms and armed security that ended up costing the network hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm joined now by Bernard White, a long-term WBAI programmer and staff member. And I wonder if you can talk about what happened at WBAI, particularly the so-called Christmas coup, where you were given a notice that you would be fired from your job and wouldn't be able to come into the station without being arrested in Christmas of 2000.
Well, it's a complicated story. I'll see if I can condense it. and still have it make sense. There was in 2000, Christmas of 2000, or was it 1999? Anyway, what happened was that there was a takeover of the national board by people who had a totally different philosophy than what had gone on at Pacifica prior to that time. They were more corporate types and more corporate thinking. And they saw not that the information was paramount, but that there was an opportunity there, they felt, to begin to raise a lot of money. There were some folks who believed that they could flip radio stations, for instance, that they could take WBAI and sell it and get a lot of money for it. At that time, I think they were talking about between $250 and $300 million, that they could take that money and buy several radio stations in the South. We were moved to Wall Street by Pacifica, basically, and told that, the reason why we had moved to Wall Street is because they were going to make the Wall Street address the primary address for the Pacifica Foundation, and they were going to operate out of there. After selling WBAI, they were going to open up a smaller radio station. One of the reasons why I was fired and my assistant, Sharan, was also fired, is because that we would have been a vocal opposition to that and would have been able to organize the staff and listeners, they felt, to oppose what it is that they were going to do. So,
well, let's step back.
At that time, we were both fired. Sharan Harper is the one I'm talking about. And I was told that I could not enter the building. If I did, I would be arrested and that no one could have me on the air to speak out about anything. A gag rule was put on all of the producers, and those who did speak out were severely disciplined. Many of them lost their programs at that particular time. And we organized a Pacifica campaign to try and tell people what was going on at Pacifica and help to organize the listeners into an effort to take it back. And I think we were out for about 13 months, and we were finally successful in forcing Pacifica, and in fact, forcing those board members who were on Pacifica, who were the most egregious, to finally leave the board.
My journey down memory lane began in February when I spent time with Bob Bailey, former president of the board, and he also served on the committee tasked with finding a new location for our station. Bob spoke about the power and determination of people involved with finding our present location. After you prepared to move into the building, how much of the work to actually put up the walls, put the equipment in, the whole nine yards. How much of that was volunteer work?
Great question. Volunteers were absolutely key. I mean, we hired almost nothing done here. A man named Steve Law was our volunteer coordinator. Today, I think Steve is a reporter for the Portland Tribune, or at least last I knew he was. Steve was our volunteer coordinator, and our objective in hiring the project manager was to hire somebody who was both experienced as a project manager, but who not only wanted to work with or was willing to work with volunteers, but liked to do that. And we ran across a great guy named Anthony Stopiello, who was an architect by training, but had worked on lots of sort of build-it-yourself projects with volunteers. And Anthony came in, and between he and Steve Law, almost the entire thing was done with volunteers. Steve was really good about plugging into the trades unions around town, the electrical workers, the sheetrock guys, the carpenters, and so on, and got them to target their apprenticeship training programs on KBOO. So it became a huge task for him and for Anthony of scheduling the trade unions and their apprentice programs to come in and do the work and do it in the right sequence, as well as volunteers from KABU who stepped forward. We had a number of people, names I don't remember, who were experienced in carpentry and concrete laying and electrical and all that, who volunteered to come down too. So, and we got an enormous amount of the materials, the studs and plywood and glass and all that stuff, donated or really at low cost. So it was a huge effort on the part of Anthony and Steve in particular to coordinate the flow of people and goods, some of which was pretty random, into a schedule that we could.
The following program aired with Gray, Pooh, and Kathleen, and this appeared on one of Jenka's programs during the year.
Crab's broadcast day was from 5 in the morning until 11, and then sign off between 11 and 5 in the afternoon and sign back on, because they didn't have a production room, and they did all their production in the main studio during midday. Plus, they really believed in the philosophy that if there wasn't anything good to put on the radio, you shouldn't put anything on the radio at all.
So,
and so during the time that Crab was maintaining those hours, KABU kind of did the same thing. And as Crab built an additional studio and was on all day, then KABU could had the opportunity or the option of repeating Crab during part of the day. And it was this repeater was well, it was less than wonderful. It was a Scott receiver located in this doctor's house up in the West Hills with an enormous antenna strapped to his chimney. And they were picking up an off-the-air signal from Seattle from a 20-kilowatt station whose antenna, if it was any lower, would have had to, it had to dug a hole in the ground to put it up. It got some good signal most of the time.
Well, tell them about the Spudnut stand.
Well, yeah, the station, Crab, was in a converted Spudnut stand, which was, all of 12 by 20 maybe?
It was maybe 15 by 20.
15 by
What's
20.
What's a Spudnut?
Spudnuts, well, that was a particular brand of donuts made with potato flour that were very popular in the Northwest. I don't know if they got out of the Northwest or not.
And there was a wooden fence around the lot.
Wooden fence around the lot. And the transmitter hung out the back of the building. Its face of the transmitter was flush with the wall of the building. And then the rest of it hung out, and there was kind of a shed roof over it.
And there was a little, like you'd chainsawed a hole in a building and put a refrigerator outside the building so you could open the door of the refrigerator from inside the building.
Yeah, that's basically it. And the whole thing was sagging, and the floor bounced up and down.
There was one microphone hung from the center of the
right
ceiling in the
for the main studio
in the room that you walked into when you came in off the street.
Right, and the control room had this board that Jeremy had nailed together out of literally boards and put kitchen linoleum on, and he had constructed this board with wires everywhere. I mean, it was completely undocumented and was had no idea what was going on. And there was one day I remember when Dave Wirtz, who ran the Bluegrass Show, got a little excited and knocked over his half gallon of sweet wine that always lived on top of the board when he's done his show, and went glug 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 through the board. And we were off the air for 2 days while I pulled the board apart and washed it. But at any rate,
the early history of KABU and of Crab are totally enmeshed.
Yeah, they're entwined. But coming back to Portland, we were trying to pick up this weird station in Seattle down here, and the commission said that we were not allowed to use Crab as the main studio for Portland. So Portland technically had to have a main studio for KABU, well, which meant we had to be able to do station identifications locally. Well, Jeremy's solution to this was to buy a Mighty Months car stereo 8-track player and gut it and to hook it up to the receiver such in a way that you could push a button in Seattle and it would trigger the Mighty Months to give an ID, right? Well, it was also set up that whenever the signal faded, it would start doing continuous IDs. So sometimes KABU consisted of continuous IDs for hours at a time when there was no signal available.
That's actually, someone told me a story of first tuning into KABU, and that's what they heard. It was this continuous ID.
Right.
So describe Dave Calhoun.
Well, once upon a time, some KABU people and myself were traveling in a car, and I realized that we were all characters from The Wizard of Oz, and the character that Calhoun was playing was the lion. At that time, he was 6'4" and had red hair. And
lots of it.
And really gruff and growly and irritable.
Big bushy beard.
And a very independent kind of guy, not exactly used to dealing well with groups of people.
Or even individually with people.
The engineering grandfather of all of the community radio stations, Benjamin Dawson, who brought Gray in, was also responsible for introducing Calhoun to all of this stuff, described Calhoun as an apprentice saint.
Why is that?
Well, he used to go to Louisville and hang out with the Trappist monks there.
And he really is, I mean, for all of his difficulty in associating with people, he does a number of good and saintly acts in his life. I mean, most recently that I know of, when Ern Hood, who was one of the founding fathers of KABU, died. Give a little history here. Ern Hood was a musician and creative weirdo in Portland for many years who had been stricken with polio as a young man. And KABU's application was signed. Application for KABU's license was signed in Ern Hood's living room. At any rate, later in his life, Ern was stricken with post-polio syndrome, which is, you know, a recurrence of polio symptoms that happens late in life. And at some point, he became respirator-bound and decided he did not want to live his life that way. And one of the people he called to help him unplug was Calhoun, to come down and talk with him about it and to help him do the act.
And that kind of thing happens typically in Calhoun's life.
Yeah.
Things that the rest of us hear about once in our lifetime is a biannual event for Calhoun.
When you say he would go get interesting records from the library, do you have any examples of what interesting meant in those days?
Well, for Calhoun, it tended towards classical music, specifically Baroque and Renaissance and medieval music, especially the early music, because in those days, nobody was playing that kind of music.
And we aren't anymore.
And it also, as a tradition from Crabb, involved a lot of what gets called ethnic music, music from other cultures. And the Multnomah County Library didn't have an extensive collection, but it was gone through almost entirely. Then whatever other resources he could come up with to get recordings of this stuff. Plus, there was, at that point, the informal bicycle network, which was a group of like-minded stations that decided to share programming amongst themselves, and they did this by exchanging tapes and called the bicycle network because the tapes got bicycled around the network, as it were. You know, when you got done with your stack of tapes, you sat on them for at least a year and a half and then mailed them to the next station.
It was a slow exchange.
Right, but, you know, who cares about timeliness?
A lot of early KABU went back down the drain because if something was archived and somebody else didn't know what it was, the tape would get grabbed and bulked and reused for...
Well, Pooh, how did you come into the picture?
I was interested in radio in high school. I'd gone to Benson, and my chums were all radio nuts. And so we were building a pirate AM radio station in my basement in the summer of 1968 in Northeast Portland. And I'd heard about this radio station that was starting up in Portland. And the next thing I know, I had started Portland State, and somehow or other, I fell in with Calhoun. And we would take these incredible midnight rides in his beat-up Volkswagen to various churches to play the organ. Ultimately, it was a year or two before I met Gray, which was the summer of 70?
69, I think. We met in 69 sometime. But anyway, I needed somebody as chief engineer of KABU who would do all the awful things that I didn't want to do or was too scared to do. That was Robert. He'd do anything. Let Mikey try it.
I kind of cut my teeth on climbing up Harold Singleton's 50-foot self-supporting tower in a sleet storm and trying to make our cobbled-together antenna system work under the direction of Benjamin Dawson.
Yeah.
And Gray and Calhoun.
So how much climbing did you do?
A lot.
Still is.
Yeah. In this half of my life, my livelihood is a product of all of my rigorous early training with KABU and climbing towers and cobbling things together.
In February, I interviewed Sheila Rubin, former program director and longtime volunteer, and Sheila shared her memories about some of the people she worked with during her time at KBOO. After Ross began his tenure here, what did you do after that?
Well, I actually, during that time, I was doing news kind of as part of my job as volunteer coordinator. But I was also training everybody, you know, to learn how to use microphones and to check out the equipment. And so I continued, you know, doing that, and I was assisting Jonathan Potkin, who was the program director, and he was, you know, an amazing classical music aficionado. And he and Phyllis Radinsky were always arguing over the phone about, you know, what what was on the classical programming. But, you know, he was a visionary in that way. And we had, you know, but at some point, he got a better place to work. And so he left his job as program director, and Michael Wells decided to have me be the interim program director. And so I did the scheduling of programs, and I did, you know, I didn't have the classical background that Jonathan had, but, you know, I knew a little bit about blues, and I knew a lot about folk, and I knew about, you know, news and public affairs. So I, you know, I pulled it together, and I, you know, ran the program committee and, you know, just started, you know, running the station. And we had been advertising for a program director, and we kept, you know, getting all these, you know, resumes, you know, from all over the, you know, country. And
who wouldn't want to come to Portland?
That's right. But one day Michael Wells sat me down and he said, you know, I don't think we want to interview any of these people. And I said, well, why not? And he said, I think we actually found the person that we'd like to be program director next. And I was like, oh my goodness, who is it? And he said, well, you've been doing an amazing job for 3 months, and, you know, the board would like to just, you know, keep you on as program director. And I was like, wow, you know, okay, you know.
So in keeping things in focus time-wise, was this like after 1980, or where were we at time-wise there?
It was probably 2 or 3. I was on staff for 5 years, and then I was a volunteer for another probably 10 or 15 years after that. So I started in 79. I was 23 years old at the time when I got promoted to program director, and I'm born in 1957. So if you do the math, you can come up with the year.
All right. Now, you have a strong, rich history with KBOO.
Yes.
And we talked a little bit about this off air, and what I'd like you to do, if you would, is if you have any particular story or memorable events that took place during that time in history that you were here, why don't you share some of that with us?
Okay, thank you. What I would say is my fond memories were all about all of the program changes and about the program committee and all about, you know, the hundreds of, literally 300 volunteers. And it was like herding cats, you know. So, you know, being program director, you know, I would get new ideas for programs. And one of the first one was Richard Francis, and he had a show of alternative music called A Different Nature. And, you know, the program committee absolutely loved that and approved it, and, you know, that got on the air real easy. And then Daniel Flesses came, and he wanted to have his show at 3 in the morning called Nocturnal Emissions. And, you know, I told him, you know, wow, Daniel, sounds like a great show idea, but, you know, the FCC would, you know, could actually shut us down if we have something on the air that is, you know, potentially, you know, not in the public interest or something. And so, you know, he changed it from Nocturnal Emissions to Nocturnal Transmissions, and so that is the show that he got. You know, and then there was Mos Musica, and show, you know, that Shahid Hamid and Muhammad started, and you know, there was a show called Mas Musica, and a show that Eugene Rashad did, and but all this time, you know, George Page had been there for years, and you know, he was an African American programmer. He was the master blaster on the weekend. There was JW Friday on Friday night, and you know, all these. You know, I was getting this word from them and from the community that we really needed to expand our African-American programming. And, you know, all of these classes of people that I was doing training in, you know, audio production, most of them were, you know, most of them were white, like me. And I just, you know, I just really had it in my heart that I wanted to, you know, make these program changes.
In there, if you would.
Well, you know, what I would say is KBOO has an amazing program charter, and the people who started KBOO, you know, have an amazing, you know, vision of what they wanted to create of alternative radio. And where things had gotten to when KBOO started was it was, you know, a lot of the, there was no classical music in, you know, in the area, and so KBOO started with primarily classical supporters and classical listenership. And by the time, you know, now we're in the early 80s, there's more people of color needing, you know, space on the air. There's more people, you know, really, you know, needing, you know, the alternative. What was alternative had, you know, changed, and there was another classical station on the air at this time, and so, you know, I was getting this movement from the community and, you know, from people that really wanted to be on the air, that we needed to have more African-American programming. So I took, I don't remember if it was 6 months or a year, but I took a significant amount of time and met with all the different program committees, the classical programmers, the folk programmers, the blues programmers, the, you know, public affairs programmers, the you know, there were others that I'm forgetting, you know, the women's soul programmers. And, you know, asked all of them, you know, about how we could shift the schedule to make room for an actual, you know, strip of African-American programming. And we worked on it very hard. I did a lot of negotiation with all the different program committees and, you know, just a lot of work of coming up with this plan of, you know, and I was like, well, let's just, you know, try this thing for a couple months of, you know, if we take off the strip of classical programming in the evening and, you know, just for a couple months, and we put on African-American programming in the evening, and we serve that community, which desperately, you know, needs to have programming, you know, what would happen? And the board was like, oh, they can't, you know, we'll lose our listener base, we'll lose our support base, oh, you know, they were scared. And the classical programmers were not, you know, particularly excited about it. But somehow we all got on the same page, and the board finally okayed this. It was a very, very tense board meeting, but they finally okayed this. And, you know, there were a lot of people. It wasn't just me, but I was the program director. But there was, like, a lot of, you know, volunteers. I'm thinking of Shahid Hamid right now, but just a lot of people that really stepped forward and really poured a lot of energy into, you know, trying to move this forward. And the board okayed it, and we, you know, we did this, and it was amazing. You know, and we had this African-American programming strip, you know, 5 days a week during drive time. And, you know, we were getting new listeners, and we were getting people that were, you know, so excited, and, you know, how are we going to do this? And
you were just broadening your listener base.
We were broadening the listener base. And so it was very exciting to me, but this period of let's just try it for a couple months was a period where, you know, I started hearing from all different people. You know, I wasn't, you know, getting the thank yous I was expecting. I was getting calls from classical programmers and their, you know, people that used to listen to their show, you know, basically threatening me, you know, I can't believe it, you know, but just saying, you know, how dare you do this? And I got, you know, calls from the African American community, you know, threatening me and saying, don't you dare take this off. And I was like, I was the person that put it on. But they didn't know that. So needless to say, it got a little heated.
Mm-hmm.
It got a little heated. And in my heart of hearts, it was a very, very good thing to do. It was a bold thing to do, and I think it was the right thing to do. But, you know, what had been magical for me at the station was that, you know, we all cooperate, we all do things together, we all work together, we're all a team. You know, there was suddenly, instead of getting all this, you know, positive energy from everyone, there was, you know, a lot of, you know, I was getting a lot of phone calls of people, you know, in support of this and in support of that and,
right,
you know, everything. And you know, and I was like 23, 24, I think it was 24 at this point, you know, and 25. And I, you know, I didn't know how to handle it. And I didn't know how to kind of step back and say, oh, you know, this is a major growth step of the station, and it's very profound what's happening here. And you know, how can I just kind of get my feet on the ground in order to kind of move forward with this? And
when all the time you were probably experiencing growing pains, and
yes,
the entire station was probably going through that same conditioning as well. And so it was probably something that was a natural thing to happen.
That's what I was trying to say. It was a natural thing. It was an organic thing. I was feeling into what was the most, you know, organic thing. What needs to come through?
Here's Jenka with another story she filed during the year while we're broadcasting. Tune in, turn on, remember, 45 years of KBOO history.
Now, this is your first piece of it is fiction, isn't it? Fictional essays, or how would you describe it?
Well,
your publisher described it as fictional essays to me, but
it's one of those things that, you know, as you read it, you can tell that a lot of it is real stuff that I've kept notes on, but I have bent it to fit into the themes of the book. So it's fiction.
What period does this represent? I mean, how long a period of writing?
This is the 70s and into the 80s. This 70. Is a 15-year period writing, uh-huh. Yeah.
But I understand you say you're really focusing on that 60s psychedelic period. I mean, is this the germ of it,
focus,
or you really want to... You say something more you want to say about that?
Well, this is what I talk about, the come-down years. This isn't about the 60s. This is after the 60s. The stories all start in 1969, which I really feel like was the time when things began to fall apart. You remember the Alice's Restaurant? You remember the other side of Alice's Restaurant when he's singing, I don't want a pickle, I just want to ride on a motorcycle? Remember, he's riding along on his motorcycle and he goes over a cliff, and as he's going over the cliff, he sings, I don't want to die, just want to ride on my motorcycle. And he says, I knew it wasn't the best thing I ever wrote, but it was the best thing I could do coming down. And that's the way I feel about it. It's not the best thing I ever wrote, but all my Kentucky writer friends told me, son, you've been in the field for 20 years. We need your report. Never
right.
mind literature.
Yep. Yep. I was getting to that. There's a lot of people have asked me, I'm sure they've asked you, if maybe when you wrote Sometimes a Great Notion, which a lot of us consider a minor masterpiece, if that might have been writing out everything. Did it take a... There's a hell of a thing to compete with. Do you feel that way at times?
Well... How many no-hitters can you pitch
yeah.
in the major leagues?
Is that what you consider, a no-hitter?
I doubt that I'll ever equal a yeah. Great Notion. I don't think I have the capacity. I don't think I have the energy or the concentration to do it. And I don't feel bad about that, except that when I talk to American writers, and one of the great things about being famous is you get to talk to other famous people. So I've had Norman Mailer here, and I've had Arthur Miller here, and, and I've had a chance to talk to Richard Hugo and people like that. And one of the things we always talk about is, what happens to American writers? Why don't we get any better? And
there was something in Esquire, too, on that, wasn't there, in this last summer issue on
reading that you were quoting? Yeah, that's a dumb thing in Esquire there.
But, yeah, I think so.
Right, yeah. But that idea you had, I mean, particularly following Cuckoo's Nest, I mean, you're talking about a boom-boom kind of effect there. That, it's very powerful. I've often wondered myself what that meant to you. I mean, to go two such resounding kinds of successes, one after the other.
Well, I've never had any doubt as to who I was. That's never bothered me. Mm-hmm. It's
how would you describe yourself then?
Well, I'm not Shakespeare, but I'm better than Barry Manilow. I know where I exist, and but that isn't it. It's what you ought to be.
And Who's ought?
Oh, my ought.
Yeah.
And then not only my ought, but there's bigger oughts than mine. Yeah. I feel about this book, I'll tell you. Now, we'll get right down to it so we don't have to fool around. I feel that what's important...
Demon Box?
Yeah, Demon Box. I feel what's important about this book to me is I found a place to put my gonzo.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that... Devlin Deborah, that persona that I speak through, and almost all of these stories in Demon Box. This isn't me any more than we have become players on our own stage, and so this box that I have tried to create is where I'm trying to put my gonzo before he eats me alive. Mm-hmm.
But don't you think, though, that since John Gardner's influence, you know, on moral fiction and so forth, that a lot of this is coming back? Now, look at Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove.
Great book.
One of the best books in the last several years.
Best book in the last 30 years, I think.
I
really
do, too.
I do, too.
Been recommending it to a lot.
Best damn book.
And that's back to a traditional way. Good characterization and so forth.
Yep.
Now, do you anticipate going back to this yourself?
I would love to. I envy the hell out of Larry.
Well, I mean, I'm... But you have an Alaska book somewhere, don't you, that you're trying to finish?
Oh, yeah. I've got 300 pages of this written.
Now, wait a minute. Now, what book did you say? What
Lonesome Dove.
Well, he's talking about an Alaska book, did you say, Paul?
He's kids working on
it. I started working on a book, but here's what happened. See, I was working hard on this. I was deep into it. But I found that the gonzo, the Kesey persona, had so much interrupted that book that I couldn't do what Larry is doing in Lonesome Dove. And I know writing well enough to know that, you know, when you can tell that when Larry takes out on that book, that's as much an adventure for him as a writer as it is for you as a reader.
It's a beautiful book.
It's a beautiful damn book. And all I want in my twilight time is to be able to write and love it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have it whip me around a post.
What will that take? I mean, to get that persona. You think you buried it with this demon box?
I haven't buried it, but
put it
but I've got a box where I can put all the stuff like it.
Is this an exorcism, or is this a...
Oh, no. I've got three times as much stuff about the Deborah characters and about all of those characters that come out of the Tom Wolfe time.
Yeah. How does this character and this reflection on this period date you, as far as it seems sort of anachronistic to me.
Oh, it is. Way. It is.
It is. It's almost stale.
I wish it had been out 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And have you read the Hemingway book?
Oh,
he's going to ask you about
that. In fact,
that.
I was up at Jack's last
sad
piece
book.
On him, yeah.
You know, if that book had
but
come
that was
out...
a damn good book.
It's a good book. If it had come out in the 30s.
Yeah.
But coming out... coming out now, it's wrong. This is what scares me.
What is the wrongness of that? I mean, how would you describe it?
Well, you know, you're talking about women with short hair and in slacks that had a certain hit then. And if it had been published then...
Even in the 20s.
Even in the 20s. It would have had that hit. But now it doesn't have that hit. Yeah. It's a different hit.
But it has a hit as far as reflected on his personality. It says a lot about him that he could never say.
But that's not what a writer wants to do, really. Shakespeare doesn't say anything about Shakespeare. I'm tired of saying stuff about Kesey. That becomes finally almost an industry.
But if Shakespeare were to write today, could he step back from being Shakespeare? Yes. With the kind of exposure, with the kind of stuff, and he would have had to go on and sell his books and hype them. Could he have pulled back and been allowed to be just old Bill Shakespeare, cranking out something back there, and maybe he's going to make it?
It would have been harder for him because, there had been Baba Wawa wanting him on television.
Did he have to go, though?
Well, you don't like to be impolite. When people ask you a question, you assume that they ask you because you know. If somebody asks me the weight of Mars, I assume I know, and I try to make something up.
That's the best way.
and this is what a fiction writer does, and pretty soon you're caught in that. That was not something that Shakespeare had to deal with.
You talk about your twilight years. How old are you?
79, 80,
80,
I'm one more time. I know he's at least 82.
Does that mean you're not going to answer my question?
No, it means I'm talking about working talent. I'm talking about Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about when you can deliver a punch and move correctly.
Can you still sound like Mailer doing this stuff?
That's right.
Well, Mailer's no dummy.
Going in the ring with Mr.
Sure.
Turgenev and all this.
Yeah, but Mailer's no dummy.
I interviewed Mailer.
Yeah, Mailer's a smart damn man, and he knows what he's talking about. He knows the stuff we're up against.
He's very critical of his own work.
There's a certain pacing about that. You can come out and maybe save yourself for the ninth round, looking into the 12th. In between, you really got to know what's in there.
I don't feel like this is... I hope this isn't my book. I got books in me yet.
Long ones?
I don't know if I've got long ones. I don't know if I've got another great notion in me.
Raymond Carver was up at his house the other day, and he said he didn't think he had any long stuff in him. He never had time to write anything long.
I saw the guy, a kid, win the world juggling contest on television last week. He juggled 12 Indian clubs. Mm-hmm. Now, I know the Brothers Karamazov. Mm-hmm. There, none of them can do that. Mm-hmm. This kid is probably 14, 16. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can only do that at a certain time. Mm-hmm. And when I was doing Great Notion, I had more balls in the air than I can keep in the air right now.
Mm-hmm. I wondered how much of that is really conscious, or is just kind of flow through you. Could you have calculated that, or was it just happening?
Oh, I'm a professional. Yeah, I know what I'm doing. And I'm doing it as full out as I can all the time. I got the metal to the floor all the time.
I understood, too, you referred also to some other kind of power than your own, whether that comes through it in the writing. Are you conscious of that when you're writing, that some of those words are just coming out, or are there...
Well, we're now talking about muse.
Yeah.
The muses. And as Wendell Berry says, it comes from musing on something, from reflecting and thinking on something. And we went through a period of time in which we were being taken by the muse without having to reflect. Uh-huh. It was moving us. And
there was a lot of schlock came out of that, too.
But that's okay.
Not you specifically, but
that's
like,
okay. I don't mind a lot of schlock. I'll sit through 4 hours of bad Grateful Dead to hear one hot piece of stuff. To get back to this thing about American writers and what it is about American writers, you know what? When I talk with Mailer and Miller and Vonnegut and Wendell Berry and Larry McMurtry and everybody about who got better in writing, you know who's the only person they can agree on that got better? Now think about the last 100 years or so. Who got better? Yeats. Yeats got better. He was writing good stuff at 80.
How about Joyce?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that he got better. I think he got more willful.
How about Henry Miller? He went along. Do you like Henry Miller?
I love Henry Miller, but I don't think he got better.
Yeah.
I don't think Faulkner got better. I don't
just
think
endured,
Hemingway got better. I don't think Steinbeck got better. Styron, none of those people. They hit their stride at a certain time, and from there on glided to the grave. I have a real sense of my talent. I know where I stand amongst people, and I know how good I am and how good I ought to be. And I'm not near as good as most great writers. And I ought to be better. And that rubs you somewhat. But when you're courting the muses, and you really want to be touched by the moving spirits, you find that you can't do it in New York. And you can't do it in Hollywood. I find that even if I'm not writing, I'm closer to it out in that field than I am when I'm back in New York. Now, with this book coming out, I'll tell you the thing that really made the difference to me was I have taken these stories and these pieces of stuff back to New York a number of times. These pieces have been available to Viking for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Why haven't they published them? Why haven't they seen them as a work? It's because they are trying to go with the gusto. There's a certain amount of media marketing. And if I'm trying to sell those cows, I don't take those cows and drive them back to New York. Mm-hmm. I bring the people from New York out to look at the cows. So I got an editor, finally. And I haven't had an editor in 10 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, Viking has changed hands three times. Right. I've had five editors. I've had all of these people who I finally convinced that I'm trying to do something, and then they change houses, or the house change hands.
Right. That's it, they move.
Right. They move. And so finally I've got this guy, Chuck Verrill, who really came to me by way of Gurney Norman, who came to me by way of Ed McClanahan, who are all of these are all my old buddies from that great writing class in Stanford. That was taught by
McMurtry
in that class. Wendell Berry was in that class. Mm-hmm. Peter Beagle.
What class
Ernie
was
Gaines.
That?
This is the famous
Malcolm Cowley.
Malcolm Cowley taught it. This is the famous Stegner writing class at Stanford. All of the people that came out of it have done well, and I've tried to understand why a number of times. And I think it goes back to Malcolm Cowley. Mm-hmm. Malcolm Cowley taught us something about writing, which has to do more than writing. Mm. It has to do with respect for writing and respect for people who have written. Mm. And whenever I do a writing seminar, the first thing I tell them is it's just as hard to write a bad novel as it is a good novel. Mm-hmm. And that you don't ever want to hurt anybody. Mm-hmm. And that when somebody publishes something good, every writer triumphs. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a competition. As a lot
That's
of
what
writers,
Cheever
right.
said, it's not a competitive sport.
Yeah, John Cheever came in and guest lectured at us, and he said this very thing. He made this point, is that so often in writing classes, writers get positioned against each other. Like people are always asking, what do you think of John Irving? You know, as though...
Because poets are worse.
But 5 minutes ago, we were talking about the quality writing and various... You're making those kinds of judgments along the way about who the top writers are and that the greatness kinds of labels we put on people and where you measure up. There is also, that is, by its nature, sounds competitive when you talk about, well, I'm great, but I'm not that great, and so on. So it starts to be a ranking system. Which
it's like throwing the javelin, though. You're not throwing the javelin against Petrinov.
I agree.
You're throwing the javelin against distance and weight.
But when it becomes a media event, it starts to be measured way, you know?
And that's what's tough.
And
that's what we don't...
your insides against their outsides. Yeah. What you know inside against how they appear. And it really is, it's not the same kind of a balance.
I'm moving off the page, and back into front of people, back around the campfire. Mm-hmm. And when I talk to writers, or when I talk to musicians, or when I talk to filmmakers, I have to overcome the fact that they're writers, or musicians, or filmmakers. I'm not interested in all of that stuff. I'm interested in only one thing, and that's the magic of it. Mm-hmm. You use whatever you can to make it go.
Are we talking about storytelling?
Storytelling, and opera, and rock and roll, and, you know, down
in other
there.
Words, but, performing.
But this, again, though, puts the writer out, as opposed to a Shakespeare, it puts you on stage. I can recall even at Oregon, I mean, the things that at those spring competition. I mean, you were out there singing and leading, writing things and so on, and that's one of the things I remembered about that time, that you were out there both as the writer, but also as director, performer, and there was something about your personality seemed to be drawn to that, and you did extremely well.
Yeah, well, I think that's what the writer was before Gutenberg. I mean,
he was maybe back in the caves, yeah. Spinning yarns, putting people in
the
face.
Well, it's like the old Eddas and the old Norse
the
storytellers.
That went from castle to castle, trying to keep civilization together by telling how beautiful the women were in the other cave, and how the strong men killed the dragon. That, to me, is what you're judged by. You walk out into an area, and it's relatively easy to draw the spotlight. That's the thing that a lot of people don't understand. My dad used to say about me, he says, you can draw a crowd in the desert. But what do you do with the crowd once you've drawn them? Can you tell them the truth? That's the thing. I mean, can you stand shoulder to shoulder with people that you respect through the ages, you know, the Bel Shem Tov of Hasidic literature? Or can you stand up there with Rimbaud? Can you stand up there with Faulkner? These are really our allies in an ongoing revolution fighting against a deadly thing in our nation today.
Which is
growing fascism.
I was going to ask you about evil. Talking about demons, and right away you come up with the concept, and I somehow that question came up for me as I looked at this.
Oh,
stuff.
Well, Melville, man.
The question
Moby
of evil.
Moby Dick is the book.
What is the evil today?
Moby Dick is the book.
I just reread it not too long ago, and it's a whole different book.
And it has to do with there is something there that we have to combat all the time.
Right.
And it isn't necessarily a human being.
Oh.
That it takes the form of a human being now and then, but it also may be a whale, it may be something inside of you, but it is ever-present, and it's off of evil that, I mean, this is the thing about Cuckoo's Nest. People think that the big nurse is the villain. She is not the villain. She is a minion of the villain, but she is not the villain. The villain is something else. If you reduce it to her being the villain, it loses its importance.
Right.
And so it's finding what the villain is. Okay, let's get back to Demon Box.
Right.
The villain in Demon Box, the villain that I was going after in this book, and successfully or not, it was what I was after, was what was it that brought us down? From where we were when we were in the 60s. From this feeling, this caring of each other, caring for each other, that we have. What was it brought us down? And what separates us? What makes us vulnerable?
Over the past year, I've met some really interesting people while doing these interviews. One in particular was Michael O'Rourke, and we got together during last year's spring membership drive. And Michael reflected back on the early days of Music from the True Vine, its history and its programmers. One other person I met was longtime KBOO programmer and volunteer Shahid Hamid. When we met, we talked about his experiences over the years, and Shahid told me what it was like to work with George Page, sharing his love for jazz and the blues and his passion for community radio. This is a part of that conversation.
When he did the music and then he did interviews and public affairs and so forth. George did jazz rap, and then he also did a blues program following jazz rap every other Saturday. And he was on for, 6 hours. 6 hours every other Saturday.
Wow, that's a long air shift.
That's a long air shift to keep people engaged as well. And he did it.
Tell us about some of the things, if you can recall, that he did to help keep that audience listening to him for 6 hours.
Well, he just knew the music. And, you know, Portland is a great blues town. It's a great jazz town, I truly believe. And George just kind of nurtured, that. And he did the music with such a flair and a knowledge of the music, and that people just gravitated toward listening to George and staying with George. I mean, Saturday was George's day on the radio, and it was Cable's day in the city. You know, I mean, he just kept you mesmerized to some degree with his knowledge of music, with his knowledge of jazz, with his knowledge of blues, and his own personal delivery.
At this time, was K-Boo involved in the Blues Festival at all?
No, this was before the Blues Festival, actually.
Okay.
The Blues Festival came out of a lot of folks working at K-Boo, and that's one of my pet peeves, that the Blues Festival should have came out of K-Boo. We should have owned that more than we did, you know, but hindsight is 2020.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the people that George influenced besides yourself. Are any of them still at K-Boo, and what were some of the things they did?
Well, I don't see too many of the folks. We got Eugene Richard. He does the motif now on Saturdays here at KBOO. Myself. A lot of folks who are not of African American descent, he influenced them as well. Daniel Flesses, host of David, he does the jazz program here, Jazz in the Afternoon. Forgive me for not knowing his name off the bat.
That's right. There will not be a test, I guarantee it.
Okay.
Now, you've mentioned it briefly a little bit ago, but because this is, after all, a community radio station, I understand that George Page really understood the essence of building community. Talk about that a little more, if you would.
Just want to just give David Lifton his due. I mentioned him earlier. Well, George, he had a, first of all, he went to the, he spent time in the community. He recruited folks from the community to come down and to get involved in K-Boo. Indian World, the program that he, John Talley, he influenced him and brought him in. He brought, Muhammad Najib in for the Muslim program. He went J.W. Friday. He brought him in, went to the community and brought the J.W. Friday, Ken and Kevin Berry. And
all these guys knew that they weren't going to get paid for. One of the things that we talked about in November was K-Boo's programming charter with Kathleen and Bruce. And it was a meaningful conversation. And one of the things that we walked away with was the fact that we really honestly believe that that programming charter helps us set the course of where we're going in the future. So we want to close out the show with our thanks to absolutely everyone that participated. And we want to remind you what our programming charter says. K-Boo shall be a model of programming, filling needs that other media do not, providing programming to unserved or underserved groups. K-Boo shall provide access and training to those communities. K-Boo News and Public Affairs Programming shall place an emphasis on providing a forum for unpopular, controversial, or neglected perspectives on important local, national, and international issues, reflecting KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO's arts, cultural, and musical programming shall cover a wide spectrum of expression from traditional to experimental and reflect the diverse cultures we serve. KBOO shall strive for spontaneity and programming excellence, both in content and technique. For KBOO Community Radio, I'm Dan Johnson.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 7:01 p.m. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Radio Cab Turkey Project, a hunger relief program providing complete Christmas dinners to families struggling with food insecurity, seniors, the infirm, and those without transportation. Information on how to make donations at radiocabfoundation.org.
Danny Glover, and I want you to listen to what I listen to, Hard Knock Radio.
Yo, this ain't your boy, this your brother, Ice Life.
Mm-hmm.
And this M1 International, RBG all day, baby. On Hard Knock Radio, word up, from 4 to 5. Check it out, sir.
Can I be the one to bring you joy?
What's up, y'all? This is Lettucey with Hard Knock Radio.
What up, everybody? If you're just tuning in, it's Hard Knock Radio. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. On today's show, we're going to let you hear an array of speeches and interviews, things to get you inspired. Among the interviews or speeches you'll hear include Immortal Technique as he commemorates the one-year commemoration of the signing of the draconian Arizona apartheid-like bill, SB 1070. You'll also hear